we can get to this right off the bat with our guest in studio. And as I referenced in the aforementioned column we posted on the site over the weekend here, we've been meaning to put up another take on public policy, as we do from time to time here on the show. And we chose the occasion of tonight's guest to kind of tie into that, and we're going to be referencing to that a little bit tonight as we talk some political philosophy. We have not, as the column referenced, had a chance really because of the scope of the show, because we don't cater merely to a local audience here, to have folks in studio here. We have to take folks on the phone lines in many cases because they are kind of far flung as far as where they're at. This gentleman, been reading his content for a while. It took me a while, definitely way too long, for the light bulb to go off in my head and say, hey, this gentleman lives in the area here. Why don't we try and invite him in for a discussion of the issues, see what he thinks on some various things here. He was gracious enough to accept. I put this in motion back around May, and we agreed we'd take a look at it here for some time this summer, and we locked in on this date a couple weeks ago here. So I've really been looking forward to doing this. This is a nice change of pace for us. I really like to do this on the show. We haven't really done a lot of public policy talk since the last presidential campaign. Again, I have a weakness for it. I really enjoy it a lot personally, but again, I know it's the kind of thing that basically on a general interest show you can really only do sporadically, but that makes it all the more fun for me when we do get a chance to do it, much less a gentleman who has written fairly prolifically on this subject, much less, as you will see in a moment here, one of my real points of fondness, a gentleman who agrees with me, who shares a political philosophy that I do, that I'm constantly pushing while I'm on this show. So having said that, it's a pleasure to welcome in on the show a gentleman who writes for a number of different publications here, Takis Magazine, The American Conservative, contributing editor to Chronicles Magazine. The Greater Cleveland area is proud to have as a resident, Tom Piatek. And so it's very nice to be able to have him in studio. Tom, welcome to the program tonight, sir.
Thanks very much, Rick.
It's great to have you in. And we've got some points that I'd like to get to here in a moment. I know you'd looked them over previously. I actually had forgotten one, and I added it subsequently. There was a note on economics here, and we'll get to that in a second. But as far as this philosophy, and we'll talk about this largely here tonight, and it's one of the main things that you write on, and so much of what you write on ties back directly to this, that being the paleoconservatism theory of politics, essentially, that has been marginalized on the conservative and the Republican side here. You've basically had the George W. Bush neocons on the one side, the liberals basically on the other. I'm curious, first of all, to know how you trace your own identification to it. For me, I'd say it goes back about as far as when Pat Buchanan was first running for president. That schism was starting to kind of come up, and I'd been in college just prior to that, and it kind of been one of these things where if you were conservative, everybody was kind of Cold War conservative, and there wasn't really this kind of splintering, but I found myself kind of going the one way on this. How did it, how do you trace your journey on this?
Well, I think my journey is very similar. I think before the Cold War ended, the American conservative movement, broadly defined, was pretty united. The defeating Soviet communism was our primary goal. And that united a lot of people who didn't have much else in common. But when that ended, there was a chance to reevaluate, and the person in the public eye who was most identified with that reevaluation was Pat Buchanan. And I supported him all three times he ran for president. I was fortunate enough to be his chairman in Ohio in 1996 and 2000. It was through following the Buchanan campaign that I became a Chronicle subscriber and became involved there. And now I'm fortunate enough to be a contributing editor. But I think, you know, there's certainly continuity with earlier thinkers. When I was in college here at Case, I did a paper on James Burnham, who wrote for National Review from its first issue until his stroke, which I think was in 1978 or 79. And in connection with that, I happened to go through all the back issues of National Review over that period of time, and a lot of what Buchanan and paleoconservatism became associated with could be traced to those earlier issues of National Review. The current magazine is far different, And unless you've gone back and read those back issues, you wouldn't realize the difference. But I think, you know, Pat Buchanan and the people who think like him can claim to be, in many respects, carrying on an earlier American conservative tradition that's been eclipsed by the rise of neoconservatism on the right.
Well, that's very interesting that you mentioned that, because I'd had a similar experience with being exposed to earlier back issues. When I got out of college, I was an intern at a place that I know you would probably have heard of, called the Leadership Institute in the Washington area, with Morton Blackwell.
Right.
And they had at their intern house there this tremendous library and back record boxes and boxes and boxes of old National Reviews. So I actually have a similar kind of story on that. And it's very interesting that you mention that, because when you talk about the magazine, you've anticipated one of the points I wanted to make during the hour here, and that being, you know, when you look at some of the pygmies that are writing for the thing right now, I mean, it really is embarrassing, the heritage of this magazine. It was a treasure at some point, and we still link to it off of our Ultimate Links page, I guess just out of some loyalty for what it was, but it's almost, you know, it's unrecognizable, really, to those of us who read the old school stuff.
Oh, I think that's correct. In fact, there's only one person writing for National Review today who I think really continues the tradition of the magazine, who is John Derbyshire, who is kind of a crypto-paleocon. He's an excellent writer, and I think, you know, he definitely disagrees with his colleagues on a number of issues. It's to National Review's credit that they keep him around, but I think he's the only one who I see carrying on the tradition of Burnham or Russell Kirk or, you know, Whitaker Chambers. I mean, some of the people who were with the magazine at its inception.
And it's really interesting, too, how it seemed to have come full circle over there, because, unfortunately, a lot of the unfair slings that have come at Pat Buchanan, one of the things that really kind of fueled that was what Bill Buckley did back around 92 when he did his infamous column and teed off on him and basically endorsed some of the charges of anti-Semitism. And yet, towards the end, it's not that he recanted that necessarily, but the noises that he was making about the Iraq War in his later years, granted he was already kind of marginalized in his own publication by that point, kind of an emeritus type voice it seemed like, but it's very interesting that towards the end, you know, it seemed to me he almost kind of redeemed himself in a way that it's become impossible for the rest of them to do because of the corner they've painted themselves into.
I think that's exactly right.
It's very unfortunate. The thing that just seems to me to really kind of exemplify the new National Review, I don't know if you remember this from a couple of years ago, but I want to say maybe it was around the time of the 04 presidential campaign. It was before Al Franken had become a senatorial candidate, when I think that there was some talk of him and Rich Lowry perhaps getting into a fist fight, and Rich Lowry kind of eventually backed down on it and tried to claim the high ground. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, that's really kind of a metaphor for the whole kind of neocon chicken hawk type philosophy. You know, when it comes time to actually face the bullets, Al Franken, you know, say what you will about him, I guess he was an amateur wrestler and everything, and I think to a guy like Rich Lowry, probably would have made mincemeat out of him. You know, it's very interesting. I mean, I might be reaching for a metaphor here, Tom, but it seemed to me that was what I was looking at.
Well, I think there's, I mean, I don't think you can look at Rich Lowry and Jonah Goldberg and Ramesh Panuru and see shades of Whitaker Chambers, the early William Buckley, James Burnham. I mean, it's just not there. And, you know, National Review has become a neocon publication, and it's also become a shill for the Republican Party. That was certainly true during the Bush presidency. Mm-hmm. Since that time, they've sort of they've disavowed their past support for Bush. But there was no question during those 8 years they supported him to the hilt. And, you know, whoever the Republicans nominate in 2012, they'll support to the hilt just because it's the Republican nominee. And rather than trying to influence public policy in a principal direction, they're foot soldiers in the Republican movement at this point.
Well, it's very interesting you mention that, because a gentleman who writes at a couple of the same publications as you, the Southern Avenger, Jack Hunter, he had an excellent take about that recently here, that the whole nature of partisanship it really kind of goes against, if you believe in a conservative philosophy, what it really stands for, it goes against it. You cannot just blindly shill for one side regardless of what they do. That seems to be lost on the National Review guys.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you know, if we're talking about the descent of National Review, I think we have to recall in 2003, David Frum wrote an essay entitled Unpatriotic Conservatives, in which he viciously attacked basically all the well-known conservative opponents of the Iraq War. He called their patriotism into question. He ended up by saying that they were siding with America's enemies. This included Pat Buchanan, this included Sam Francis, this included Tom Fleming, the editor of Chronicles. All three of those gentlemen I had the privilege of know, privilege to know. I mean, what Frum did was a slander. I was put on the front cover of National Review. They've never disavowed it. And the irony is that David Frum was not, at the time he wrote the essay, was not even an American citizen.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Canadian, or he had only recently become an American citizen. So here was a foreign interloper calling into question the patriotism of people who had been serving in the conservative movement for a long time on the basis of what we can now see clearly was a failed and disastrous policy, and which those whom Frum slandered saw from the beginning would be a disaster for the United States.
You know, and when you mentioned that specific article, that was the most shameful thing they've done on a personal level. But on a policy level, they might have done themselves even one worse. I want to say it was about 2-3 years prior to that. You mentioned a minute ago the name Jonah Goldberg. The thing that I will think about with him the rest of my life is that asinine column that he put up about how we should invade Africa. This was in that kind of placid time there.
Right.
We need a new challenge, national greatness, blah, blah, blah. That right there of just looking for trouble, it was somewhere in that time right before 9/11, and it's just, if you want to know what the neocons really stand for, look at that. The guy wanted to invade Africa to, quote-unquote, civilize a continent.
Yeah, no, it was completely insane. Once again, you know, Goldberg hasn't stepped away from it. And the irony is that none of these guys really have paid a price politically for being wrong so often. You know, Goldberg's career certainly hasn't suffered from being a Bush supporter, an Iraq War supporter, writing the idiotic column you mentioned. And, you know, they're not called to account. It's very odd. I mean, apparently punditry is one profession where being wrong really is not a hindrance to career advancement.
No. No, apparently it is not. And as far as, you know, a sane philosophy to counter that, which we're going to be talking about here tonight, before I get into that and some of the bullet points as I had seen them and see what you think of these and how you would agree with the classifications and how you would not, let me just ask you again, as far as, you know, a personal level for you, we've traced your sort of origin into this. I imagine you probably have to do this less than I do because, you know, you write for these publications. Your friends and family are probably more, you know, relatively familiar with your philosophy on this. I find myself, even with friends and family, having to explain things on this because everybody's caught up in this left-right divide as it's defined by the media. Do you still find yourself having to do that from time to time as far as, you know, what this particular philosophy is about? And when you do encounter that, what are some of the key points that you make?
Well, I think you're right, because what people see on television and hear on the radio largely excludes the sort of viewpoints we're talking about. And I think the way to counter that is by speaking about two specific issues and get people to focus on the substance of the issues and rather than what American politics has become, which is almost like a sporting event where you have a red team and a blue team and you decide which team you're a partisan of and you just root for that team, you know, as in the sports world, you know, when the players change, when the coach change, it doesn't matter. You'll still root for the red team or the blue team because that's who you identify with. And I think the way to cut through that is to focus on the merits of specific issues and try to get people to think about the specific issues rather than worrying about what side they're on in the contest they hear about all the time on the various radio shows and television shows. political shows on television.
It really does, mitigate against people having a mind of their own on stuff, thinking through, reasoning through on stuff. I mean, I can just tell you in my personal experience, whenever I find, tell my dad that I'm laughing at one of his OMG secret Muslim emails about Obama, what? You support Obama? It's a thing where if you don't think that a certain specific thing is through, and I personally would be the last thing anybody would call an Obama supporter, it's just funny how that can kind of get thrown around if you don't buy into every last thing on down the line.
Well, I think that's accurate. And some of the things, I read something, I get these emails too that, friends forward to me, and there was one about Obama fomenting a socialist conspiracy that he learned at in Columbia University, and one of the particulars was favoring statehood for Puerto Rico. Well, Newt Gingrich made a big point of favoring statehood for Puerto Rico. One of the points was supporting the bank bailout. Well, of course, TARP was signed into law by George Bush, and John McCain suspended his campaign to go back to vote for TARP in Washington. The other item was amnesty for illegal aliens. Well, both George Bush and John McCain advocated what they called a path to citizenship for illegal aliens. So, are we to believe that Obama is such a fiendishly clever conspirator that he's able to enlist Republicans into fomenting his conspiracy before he even before he even really was on the scene in some cases? No, but that's the level to which our political discourse has sunk in many cases. And it's, I think the reaction against Obama in many ways is a healthy one, but it poses a danger, too. I remember very clearly the focus, the obsession with Bill Clinton. And, there are various conspiracy theories about Bill Clinton and how he was sort of evil incarnate. And, by the end of the Clinton presidency, the American consensus was, well, we need someone who's not going to be a Clinton, by which I think a lot of people felt we needed someone who we thought was honest and who we thought would not be sexually molesting aides in the White House. And George W. Bush was honest, and no one thought that he would, go after someone like Monica Lewinsky. And in that, he fulfilled what he was elected to do. He was not caught up in the sordid personal scandals that Bill Clinton was. Was he a good president? No, he was a disastrous president. And I think his presidency will have negative long-term consequences for the United States. But the obsession with Clinton, the need to defeat Gore at all costs, led directly to the nomination and election of George W. Bush.
No, that's true. That's true. And again, not really setting the bar high. Go in there, appear to be honest, and don't molest anybody in the White House. That's what we get for it. And I think that's what we're talking about here tonight. Let's try and set the bar a little higher. So we've talked about a number of things here that we're against. Let's talk about some things that we're for. These are my characterizations, bullet points on down the line here as far as what this paleocon philosophy stands for in my personal estimation here. So I'll run through the bullet points and I'll see where you agree and disagree, Tom. On foreign policy, neither the pansy pacifism of the post-60s left nor the reflexive militarism of the neocons, best exemplified by William Kristol calling for the United States to invade Iran as a means of settling the Israel-Hezbollah war of 06. Instead, a common-sense non-interventionism that calls for overwhelming force only in those rare instances where America's vital national interest is truly at stake. Trade. Neither the trade wars be damned protectionism of the ivory tower left, nor the unrestricted free trade of the neocons that leads to unilateral economic surrender, but a fair trade policy that seeks a level playing field with our trading partners around the world. Economics. Neither the Marx-inspired hate for the sake of hate approach to the big business of the left, nor the blind worship of all things demanded by the Fortune 500 on the neocon side, but the knowledge that big business is a force that operates solely according to what is best for it, for good or for ill, often eager to co-opt big government to crush the real backbone of America, small business. Border security and national sovereignty. The commitment to preserving the sanctity of the nation's borders that the neocons have been dragged to kicking and screaming, but have never advanced an inch. Social issues, such as defense of traditional marriage, protection of innocent unborn life, respect for religious holidays and institutions, etc. Commitment stemming from respect for the historic successes of Western civilization to carry out the positions that the neocons mouth half-heartedly but do not implement. Opposition to big government and respect for the 10th Amendment, see social issues. So in terms of this, I don't even want to use the term third way, because that's what a lot of the, you know, the Democratic Leadership Council folks have tried to kind of co-opt over the years. But the this third approach to public policy in America here, as far as these bullet points, agree or disagree on any of them, Tom?
I think that's a pretty fair summary. I think there are a lot of things that both sides ignore, and where, frankly, the American people largely agree with us, even though they're not, you know, the paleo-conservative voices are not what's being heard. Trade, you mentioned, is an example. I mean, the public policy, public opinion is much more favorable toward a more traditional American position on trade, which frankly was, you know, not a reflexive protectionism, but a thoughtful protectionism, which characterized our policy. The first substantive act passed by the first Congress was a tariff. And the purpose of the tariff was not only to raise revenue, it was also, it states in the preamble, to encourage manufacturing in the United States. And that was the policy largely until the mid part of the 20th century, when after World War II, we took a break. We started lowering our tariffs because Europe had been devastated by the war, and that was largely driven by foreign policy concerns. But at some point, once Europe was back on its feet, we did not revert to our historic policy. We adopted free trade, just as the British Empire done in 18, in rough at the peak of its power, and we're getting the same thing from that policy shift that the British did, which is the British went into, in 1860, they were the leading manufacturing power on earth. By the brink of World War I, they had been eclipsed by both the United States and Germany, both of which had a more protectionist policy. Again, the public sees the jobs going to China. They see the factories closing. They realize what's going on, but they're told by both parties, more or less, the leadership of both parties, that, well, untrammeled free trade is the way to go. Immigration, you mentioned that. I mean, Congress had even passed legislation authorizing a border fence. Both President Obama and President Bush have dragged their feet on that. They don't want a border fence. Neither of them had any interest in solving what is really an invasion of the United States from Mexico. A problem that could be relatively easily solved, and they've shown no interest in solving it. Instead, they tell us, well, there are now so many illegal immigrants here, we've got to give them some sort of, we've got to regularize them, we've got to legalize them. But the public is overwhelmingly opposed, which is why there hasn't been amnesty legislation passed in Congress. Economics, I think you're correct. There's definitely is a public sentiment in favor of a more of a middle ground, a pro Main Street, less beholden to Wall Street policy approach. But of course, both parties take lots of money from Wall Street and have been carrying water for Wall Street for a while. And that has led directly to the serious economic problems we're facing today. So I think that there are, I think your summary is correct. In large measure, foreign policy is also an area where the American people have more interest in, actually defending the United States than in becoming a world policeman. And again, that's traditional American policy. If you look at George Washington's farewell address, a document that Washington worked on for a long time with the assistance of Alexander Hamilton. I mean, he sets forth what should be the foreign policy of the United States, which is no permanent entangling alliances. And here it is, 20 years after the end of the Cold War, and not only are we still a part of NATO, but NATO is expanding to defend Western Europe, a prosperous, strong part of the world, from a Red Army that no longer exists. It makes no sense, but yet we continue doing it.
Well, and then by the same measure, really, you've got the Korean Peninsula, and that's an absolute tripwire right there. And it's a situation where the South Koreans, you know, unlike the Europeans, who I haven't heard real strong opinions one way or another, the South Koreans, in a large measure, don't seem to want us there, don't seem grateful. My point of view on that would be, let's pull out our 30,000 guys. You have a strong man with nukes to the north here. Eventually, it seems something very bad is going to happen, and that is going to be something where it would seem to me an unjustified price is going to be paid by our soldiers defending a country that doesn't even, it seems ambivalent as to whether they're really grateful for it in the first place.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, South Korea is like Western Europe. It's more than capable of defending itself. South Korea's economy is vastly larger than North Korea's. Their population is larger. They're in all measures a stronger society. They don't need our support. They don't need our military support in terms of American troops guarding the DMZ, being positioned to be the first to die in a second Korean War. And I think I don't know what Korean public opinion is, but I do know the fact that, you know, certainly Korea practices the same sort of economic policy vis-a-vis the United States that the other East Asian countries have done, which has been to keep their own economies protected from American imports, and to, you know, use the United States as a place to sell their products, often undercutting our own manufacturers, often causing Americans to lose jobs in the process. So no, it's not a relationship that's beneficial to the United States, and that really should be the bottom line. What's good for the United States? Unfortunately, we have a leadership class which seems indifferent to that question.
They certainly are, and a leadership class that certainly spans both parties there. That hot-button issue of economics, we'll take a look at that on the other side. We are mandated to take our bottom-of-the-hour break. When we come back on the other side, we'll continue to look at this. We'll continue to develop here what America should be doing. Basically, we're taking the opportunity tonight here to call the bluff of America. The polls are showing they're sick and tired of the direction that we're going in. Nobody is evincing a whole lot of nostalgia for where we were 2 or 3 years ago. So what are the answers? We feel like we've got them here for you tonight.